Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nached poing aun FM, Kralevo Burnaby, Britombia.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
From Palestine, this is a special edition of the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Lots of reports in the news these days about Israeli military assaults on Palestinian refugee camps in Little Gaza. Refugee camps are reduced to rubble by 2,000-pound bombs or plowed in mud by armored Caterpillar D9 bulldozers in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Refugee camps are routinely assaulted by heavily armed soldiers or police in search of terrorists to arrest, or more likely, gun down, no questions asked. For those who've never visited a Palestinian refugee camp, these are not dense tent or tin shack encampments. They're more like barrios, densely packed, tightly knit, fully functioning communities. On a very recent trip, I visited one of Palestine's largest refugee camps, Aida, in the southern West Bank town of Bethlehem, founded in 1950 to house 1,200 victims of Israeli ethnic cleansing. Aida is now home to about 6,000. It's a safe, welcoming place to walk, talk, and film, a vibrant community packed with art and political graffiti. But violent assault is always imminent, especially at night. Heavily armed Israeli border police enter in armored vehicles through sliding steel doors along Israel's apartheid wall that snakes along Aida's northern edge. I spoke about all this with one of the authors of a 2008 report entitled No Safe Space: Health Consequences of Tear Gas Exposure Among Palestine Refugees. Rohini Har is assistant adjunct professor of epidemiology and a research fellow in the Human Rights Center of University of California, Berkeley.
Tear gas is frequently used. Reports locally in the news and by NERWA say it's like multiple times a week for over a year or two. And the other kind of misconception a lot of people have is that it's mostly used in a limited setting, like against like little boys and teenage boys who are throwing stones. But that's actually not what the reports indicate. They indicate that a minority of the incidents involve any like stone throwing or aggressive behavior by the Palestinians, that a lot of it is arbitrary. And a lot of it is actually part of raids or part of arrests to go arrest people. So tear gas is used kind of as an offensive to irritate and kind of disorient people so that they can go arrest who they want to arrest. And so we looked at that context. Of course, we got ethics approval from Berkeley and then sort of had a lot of work on the ground to plan and make sure that our methodology was as sound as it could be.
And then you carried out surveys.
Correct. So the research itself was kind of three-part. One was we did days and days and days of focus groups with, I think, maybe more than like 11 different groups of people and over 70 people. So out of the 6,000 people that live in Aida camp, and we actually even also did a few focus groups in Dahesha camp, we interviewed groups of teachers, students of different ages, you know, teenage students as well as very young students, mothers, pregnant and nursing women. We did a group of elderly people, sanitation workers, all kinds of different groups to try to get a sense of what everyone's different experiences are and what they find concerning. And also, you know, they live with it every day. They have different ideas on what solutions could possibly be. So we looked at that as well. And so we asked a lot of open-ended questions. And based on those answers and on a set of previously validated questions about chemical exposures by the CDC and the general health questionnaire, which is a validated mental health screening tool, we conducted 230 or 240 odd surveys around the camp. And so that was part two. And then part three is people who complained of like ongoing symptoms or had any medical problems. We did medical evaluations of them, forensic evaluations, to see if we could identify any specific findings on their physical or psychological exams.
Tell me about the tear gas that Israeli security forces use. It's not, I gather, your old-fashioned typical form of tear gas.
I wish I could tell you more about it, but unfortunately there's zero transparency on what they're using. What we know is that the majority of it is fired from like a tank kind of things, like in 90 or 100 groups of small canisters. So this isn't just, you know, one grenade that's going off once in a while. It's more like a little machine gun full of tear gas. One thing that we don't know is the exact chemical makeup. A lot of people are concerned that they're using a newer form of tear gas. We know that newer forms of tear gas, which is CS or CN gas, exist, that they last longer in the air, that they're more repellent to water so that you can't wash them off as easily. But I have no idea what the Israelis are using, which is another problem, because then there's more fear and paranoia around what's going on.
And your report indicates that they may be siliconized, whatever that means.
Yeah, so that's CS1, CS2 gas are kind of newer forms of tear gas that are kind of the small, like, little powder is covered in silicone so that it doesn't wash off with water as well.
So what are the medical effects that you've documented? What sort of physical effects do people complain of?
So, I mean, obviously it's called tear gas for a reason. It causes tearing, but what we call blepharospasm, which is that you uncontrollably, like, cannot open your eyes, or it burns your eyes a lot when you try to open them. And that's very disorienting because, you know, the whole point of tear gas is to, like, basically dispel crowds and make the area safe. But if you can't see anything, then it's really, really hard to run away and get away from it. We also know classically that tear gas causes trouble breathing and skin problems. Those are the, like, burning of the skin. Those are the three main things that you expect tear gas to do, but you only expect them to last for a very short amount of time, 15, 20, 30 minutes. What we found there is that those symptoms are lasting much longer than we expected, sometimes a day, sometimes actually even longer. And that because people are exposed to tear gas over multiple days for weeks and weeks on end, that they're having more chronic symptoms as well. Headaches, allergic reactions, and really every part of their body is being affected by it. And this isn't just like healthy, you know, 18-year-old. This is like 2-month-old big pregnant women, 85-year-old, you know, retirees, people with asthma and people with diabetes and other medical problems. And so we're seeing a whole range of medical issues in them. And then the last thing I'll mention is that a lot of people complain that it's not just at the time that the tear gas is around. It's because they feel like this powder is lasting in the air. So when it hits inside their house or on the street, every time it's kicked up or that powder kind of gets re-aerosolized, that it causes symptoms again for 3-4 days afterwards as well.
And women complain about miscarriages.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, something that's really hard to prove, and we don't try to prove anything like that. But a lot of people attribute miscarriages to their tear gas exposure.
And it's interesting that these events of the security forces going into the camps, and it's a daily routine, and it's not, as you say, directly correlated to political tension or nonviolent or violent protests or stone throwing. Israeli troops just go in and do it without any provocation.
That's generally what people are reporting, that these are not provoked incidents where they're, you know, typically you're supposed to only use tear gas when you're protecting public safety, but that's not at all what we hear reports of.
What are the mental health effects and sort of emotional effects, mental health effects and consequences of this exposure to tear gas?
Sure. My colleague Jess Gunham at UCSF focused on the mental health effects there because they're quite profound. And I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I will summarize and tell you that they are pretty profound in terms of this. What he really focuses on is a sense of helplessness. So people normalize what's going on because they're dealing with it every day from, you know, childhood onwards. And at the same time, you know, there's this constant sense of they're feeling helpless, like there's nothing they can do about it. They can't, you know, there's no one they can go to. This is not a government that they elected. It's an occupying power. So they feel like there's no one that can protect them from it. And at the same time, there's nothing they can do to prevent it. And then especially when parents see their children and their mothers and grandmothers and things exposed, they feel especially helpless because they can't protect their children from this kind of exposure at all.
Interesting a quote from your report that some non-United Nations hospitals indicated that they've not kept records of these kinds of events since experiencing raids to search for persons and records, that hospitals intentionally don't keep records of treating people who've been exposed to tear gas precisely because the security forces come in and confiscate the records.
So, I mean, I cannot speak enough about this. The majority of my research is on medical neutrality, especially in conflict. And let me just say that this is so deeply concerning that medical professionals do not feel safe documenting what they find in their medical records, because not only is that a violation of basic general neutrality, it's also really dangerous for patients because there's no record of them being there. And so when they come back, when they have chronic problems, there's no idea what's going on with them.
Can you tell me anything, Rohini, about the legal status of the use of chemical irritants of this sort in environments such as these camps in Palestine?
Yeah, so the 1992 UN Convention Against Chemical Weapons banned the use of all chemical weapons, including tear gas, in conflict zones. Tear gas and other crowd control weapons are permitted for public safety for civilian police to police their own communities, right? So, for instance, the United States is allowed to use it when there is a dangerous protest. We often use it, frankly, in the U.S. when there's not a dangerous protest. In Canada, you know, there was probably excessive use of it during the Native American protests in Toronto, but it was still a legal use. The concern here is that in Palestine, they're not community policing. This is an occupying power. And so really, technically, you're probably violating humanitarian law because this is still like an active and ongoing conflict. Admittedly, it's been dragged out and very long, but the use of tear gas, it's not entirely clear that that's even legal in this situation.
And it is, in a sense, a form of collective punishment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way it's being used from our reports is that, like, it's not like people are being dispelled when they're rioting or damaging buildings or harming public safety or blocking roads. This is just going into people's homes. You know, like they're just cooking dinner or it's 2 a.m. and someone nearby is getting arrested and they just, it's all over their house and they can't get out of it, can't get into it. I mean, and, you know, we're talking about small apartment buildings, but this is a really, really poor area. So people don't have good ventilation and they don't have good windows that shut and close. Everybody's windows and doors are. And so they're not able to protect themselves against it.
We've been talking about the use of tear gas, but how about the use of skunk?
So skunk was not, when I was there, we did the initial research in August, and skunk had not been used for, you know, at least 2017. But since the United States made the announcement about moving the embassy to Jerusalem, there's been a bit more protest. And then reports and news media show that skunk has been used again. Now you're going to ask me what skunk is.
Well, I know what skunk is. I've run hard to avoid it.
Yes, which you should, because it's disgusting.
But for those listeners who don't know what skunk is, can you tell us?
Yeah, so basically skunk spray is is only used in the occupied territories by Israel. Anywhere else in the world, I've never seen it used. It's never been reported to be used. Basically, it's this, like, they say it's organic, but it's like this yeasty, terrible, foul-smelling spray. So instead of a water cannon just spraying water, it sprays this terrible, foul-smelling spray that can last weeks and weeks until it rains or until it gets washed away or something. It covers houses, it covers businesses, it covers everything on the street and the neighborhood. It makes it so you can't even live there. And so this is a classic form of collective punishment, and not only, you know, in the acute, but over days and weeks. So people have to close down businesses because when the stuff is sprayed, no one can be there.
And I gather, I've heard reports that exposure to skunk actually causes, not surprisingly, skin irritation.
Nausea, vomiting, yeah, stomach irritation. It sounds like it's just disgusting stuff.
Rohini Har was the co-author, together with Jess Ganim, of No Safe Space, Health Consequences of Tear Gas Exposure Among Palestine Refugees. The report was published in January 2018 by the Human Rights Center of the School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. The situation is pretty much the same today as it was back then. We'll link to that report at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Refugee camp is a bustling and vibrant community. It's also something of an outdoor art gallery. Resistance artwork, portraits of iconic poets and revolutionary fighters, and political graffiti adorn its walls and facades. One of Ida's best-known hubs for resistance art and culture, the Al-Rawad Culture and Arts Society and Vocational Training Center, Abdel Fattah Abu Sroor, is the center's founder and director. Introduce yourself. Tell me who you are.
So my name is Abdel Fattah Abu Sroor. I am founder and director of Arwad Cultural and Arts Society in Aida refugee camp, Bethlehem, Palestine.
What is Arwad?
Arwad is a cultural, educational, artistic center, which I founded with a group of friends in 1998, trying to provide possibilities for children and young people and women to express themselves in the most beautiful, creative, peaceful ways, and hopefully think living rather than just dying for their country or whatever cause they are defending. We started with theater, adding dance, singing, music, photography, video as a way to inspire hope and promote life and give that way of expression for children and young people shouting as loud as they want, hopefully, to build peace within themselves, to be peace builders in their community and beyond. So it's a philosophy that I call beautiful resistance, because I believe every act of resistance against injustice, oppression, occupation is a beautiful act of humanity. And also celebrating our resistance as people who almost 99% never carried a gun in their life, and they resisted through keeping their heritage, identity, folklore, traditions, and generosity and hospitality. And celebrating this spirit of inclusion and not exclusion, because Palestine was, is, and will continue to be a land of multiplicity and diversity, a land of inclusion and not just exclusion. Every exclusive mentality is racist by nature. So Arwad started as a philosophy to inspire hope and promote life in times where, when you ask children their hopes and dreams, many will say, of course, I want to be doctor, engineer, lawyer, pilot, teacher, and so on. But some look you in the face and say, I want to die.
Do they?
Yes, they do. And when a child who is 8 or 10 years old tell you, I want to die, and ask, why do you want to die? Most frequently they will say, because nobody cares. Because when the Israeli soldiers come in the middle of the night or at 5 in the morning, nobody is there to protect. Because when they put our houses upside down, nobody is there to protect. Because when they come and kidnap these children from their parents' house and take them and interrogate them alone, without even the presence of a lawyer or the protection of an adult, there is nobody cares. And we can see now, even in the last few years, children from Gaza or in the West Bank, a lot of time when they are asked their hopes and dreams, when they grow up, they say, we don't grow up in Palestine. We are killed before we age. So this is the tragedy that children are living in. Hopelessness, despair, lack of trust in a future, lack of trust in the whole this international hypocritic community, which gives the right for the oppressor to defend itself, but not the oppressed to defend themselves.
And Palestinians have the right to resist. We never hear about this or read about this from world leaders, from Biden or Trudeau or Macron, or much less Rishi Sunak. They talk about Israel's right to defend itself in Gaza, but Palestinians don't have the right to resist and or defend themselves, certainly not violently and not even peacefully.
This is the world on the opposite side, because according to UN resolutions, according to international law, oppressed people have the legitimate right to resist by all means, and that includes armed struggle, which most Palestinians did not go to. They go to non-armed way of a struggle mostly, but they have also that legitimate right to resist through armed struggle ways. And in the same time, no resolution in the UN, no international law have given the right of the oppressor, of the occupying power, to defend themselves against the people who are oppressed by them. So it's the world on the other side, le monde à l'envers, as it's said in French. So that's why, I guess, for us, we reclaim that right to defend ourselves, but even we reclaim that right also to live in peace, based on justice and equality, not based on to be enslaved and oppressed and be thankful and grateful for the oppressor to do that. And in the same time, we do recognize that this is a political problem and not a humanitarian tragedy. A lot of people try to confuse the Palestinian cause as a humanitarian cause, while it's a political cause that we are poor, not because we are lazy or we don't have resources. We are put into the poverty on one side by this illegal Israeli occupation, which deprives us from the right to circulate freely, to import, to export, to manufacture, even to fall in love with whoever we want and get married with whoever we want. But this segregation between Palestine, 48, Jerusalem, Gaza, the West Bank, the world, but also by donor countries which come to dictate us what we should do rather than consult with us and help us do what we really need to do. People come to throw some crumbs on the table and say, we have helped these poor, miserable people to remain miserable for the rest of their lives. People are sending humanitarian aid to Gaza and even throw them by planes, and Mr. Biden want to make a port in the sea. Well, the easiest way is to open the borders and allow all these vehicles that are full with the humanitarian aid to pass through, and not to invent ways, acrobatic ways, of dropping shipments from the sea, from the plane, and even kill people or go in different directions and dehumanize people one way or the other.
Tell me about Aida refugee camp.
Aida refugee camp is one of 58 refugee camps officially established by UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which was created by the UN for Palestinian refugees. So Aida refugee camp is one of 58 refugee camps which were established by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which was specifically created for Palestinian refugees. Since our tragedy was made by a UN partition plan, not by natural catastrophes or civil wars. And Aida is one of the 19 refugee camps in the West Bank, one of the three in Bethlehem area. It has a population today of about 6,200 people, or more than 7,000 according to records. Two-thirds of this population are under 24 years old, living on a space of 0.07 square kilometers. So it's very small space. And above that, surrounded by this illegal wall of expansion and annexation on the north and east, with six towers of snipers, cameras of surveillance, and incursions by the Israeli occupation army very frequently. This camp was classified as the zone the most exposed to tear gas in the world in a study by Berkeley University team in 2017. So the challenge with young people with the high rate of unemployment rate, nowadays, since the 7th of October, all the cities were locked down, and then they opened a little bit, but nobody is able to go to work on the Israeli side in one way. And on the other side, not a lot of tourism is happening. You know, Bethlehem is almost 90% dependent on tourism for its income. So that means 90% of unemployment rate. That means all the workers who go on the other side are not able to work. So that adds to this unemployment rate. That means also that even the Palestinian Authority employees who are not receiving full salaries are also in great need. So it has been a catastrophic situation on different levels. Gaza is massive killing and large-scale genocide and destruction. And the West Bank is a smaller scale, continuous, persistent, the uprooting people from their lands, confiscating lands, attacks of the settlers, and so on. Here in Aida, we are a little bit kind of isolated from the settlers' direct contact. But the colonies within Bethlehem, more than 24 colonies, expanding. The settlers are armed with, you probably know. And so they are attacking villages in the southeast of Bethlehem, in the west of Bethlehem as well, and taking lands in Al-Walaja or in Tqua' and areas of Bani Ta'mar and so on, and on the south part towards Hebron Road as well.
But and Aida refugee camp is surrounded by Israel's wall.
Yes.
The wall is this huge,
ugly structure
with seven checkpoints, seven watchtowers and checkpoints.
Yeah.
Tell me about this. And you see the big gate that allows the soldiers to come through in their vehicles through the wall.
Yes.
And they enter Aida.
Yes. So the wall started in 2002 as barbed wires and then made in concrete wall with blocks of cement that goes 3 meters deep in the ground and 8 meters above the ground, with cameras of surveillance and with one tank, one automatic gun, I guess, for skunk water on the road towards Hebron-Jerusalem Road. So it's on the east part of Aida camp. And one also on just near the cemetery, an automatic gun for tear gas canisters. So as you know, it was previously that the jeeps come with their automatic shooting gun for tear gas and so on. Now they have installed into Aida. Now they have installed on the wall itself near the Mosque of Bilal ibn Rabah, which they refer to as the Rachel tomb, an automatic gun for tear gas canisters as well.
An automatic gun for tear gas canisters.
Yes. So you can see that. It's visible. It's not hidden and so on. And people can take that. Next to the cameras, they have also full surveillance for Aida camp with the watchtowers as well as with the cameras surrounding the camp. So it is one of the most exposed to incursions by the Israeli occupation army very frequently. And
these days, I mean, since October 7th, how frequently do the Israeli soldiers come into Aida?
In fact, Aida was frequently, so what expanded was the level of arresting of young people. About 84 young people were arrested on the 7th of October, and five injured with real bullets, explosive bullets that explode in the bones as well. And one of the young people had like it.